1898, Marquis Who's Who has offered our distinguished listees the opportunity to set themselves apart through our print publications. Now, Marquis Radio offers these illustrious professionals the opportunity to shine in our one-on-one interviews. My guest today is Dr. Daniel Botkin, who is an emeritus professor of biology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. How are you doing today, Daniel?
I'm doing fine. It's a nice sunny day where I am, and it's nice to talk with you.
I'm glad to hear it. It's nice to talk to you as well. Well, why don't you start by telling us what you'd like to focus on for this interview segment?
Well, I've worked in ecology for 50 years. When I went into ecology, nobody had ever heard of it except for a small number. There were only five professors in the United States that taught plant ecology. When I told my friends I was going into ecology, meaning an environmental science, I said, I found a field that I really like and nobody's ever going to hear from me again. I loved being out in wilderness. I love being out in forests. And I also, having had an undergraduate degree in physics, was very interested in computers. And this was in 1965, so I was one of the first people to start using computers to deal with environmental issues, while at the same time I was doing wilderness research soon after that in such places as Isle Royale National Park, which is in the middle of Lake Superior, one of the greatest wildernesses in the United States, never having been touched by people. So I've just done a whole variety of things, and I've also tried not only to do basic science, but I've tried to help solve major environmental problems. And so I've done quite a variety of those, from dealing with what were the causes of the declines of salmon in the state of Oregon and Washington. I actually spent 10 years part-time with that. I helped the city of Los Angeles and California. There's a famous lake called Mono Lake that was used by 1.3 million birds, and the water that flowed into the lake was being completely diverted, providing 17% of the water for the city of Los Angeles. And in the 1980s, that became a major California issue. People had stickers on their cars that said, "Save Mono Lake." And it got to be such a controversy that the state of Oregon passed a bill to have a scientific study, which they then asked me to lead. And we actually were able to solve the problem, resolve what needed to be done, and led to a complete reversal of court decisions about Mono Lake. So I've tried to do the whole range of things, from fundamental experience, nature in the wild, to trying to forecast about nature using computers, and to trying to help solve environmental problems. And then I've also had this side issue. My father was a major folklorist in the 20th century. My father authored A Treasury of American Folklore. That was listed in 2012 as one of the 100 books that shaped America. So I grew up around folk music. I made a record at the Library of Congress when I was 6 and a half, me singing. And a lot of the famous folk singers were family friends, and I was around folk music and folk musicians. And in recent years, I've started a new project called What Makes Us One, because in this time when there's so much disparity and arguments and disagreements, music brings people together. And in other times when we've had that kind of problem, a lot of dissension in the United States, people have always written protest songs like We Shall Overcome. Today, we live in a time where there are no protest songs. There's just a lot of disagreement. So in this part of my career, I'm bringing that to the fore and trying to help bring folk music back to the center and help people get on better. So it's kind of a diverse life.
Indeed. So let's start with your work in wilderness research. How did you develop predictive models of nature?
Well, I used to, when I was a graduate student, first of all, I took courses in the fundamentals of how plants grew, the physiology and physics of plant growth. And there was some very straightforward and well-studied for over a century mathematical equations that explained and worked very well about plant growth. And I had a wonderful major professor named Murray Buell, who loved to go out and walk in the woods. And he had me appointed as caretaker of the Hutchison Memorial Forest while I was a graduate student. That was the last remaining, never cut, never burned stand of forest in New Jersey. And we would go for walks, and we'd come to a place where there'd be a tree that didn't usually grow there. And Murray would stand back and he'd say, "Dan, why do you think that tree's growing there?" And he and I would talk. And by the end of our discussion, we had persuaded ourselves that we understood why that tree was there. But in the back of my mind, I thought, maybe we're just persuading ourselves and we really haven't gotten the right answer. But there's all this mathematics about how plants grow. And it seems to me I ought to be able to turn that into a computer program that would grow forests. Then I was very fortunate in 1970, IBM Thomas J. Watson Research Center had 7 projects for the summer that dealt with societal problems. And they invited me to go to their research lab and make a presentation. And two of IBM's scientists, Jim Wallace and Jim Janik, one was a theoretical physicist and the other was a statistician in forestry. They both really liked my idea. And so in a summer, we created a computer model of forests that actually worked. And so that's the story. It was a story that was a combination of walking around in the woods, trying to figure out how things worked, doing a lot of reading research to figure out what people actually knew, and then making use of this newfangled computer modeling. And with the help of these two wonderful scientists, we then created a model, and it's still in use all around the world and still very well validated.
And what kind of variables did you need to use to ascertain what the future of the forest would look like?
Oh, well, the two of the main variables which feed into the climate discussion, and we were able to use the output from the climate models, were temperature and sunlight. And then we also added the nutrient conditions in the soil. And the trees competed for sunlight, so taller trees shaded smaller trees, and each species had its own specific characteristics. But those were the main variables: sunlight, temperature, rainfall, and soil minerals.
And was this experience with IBM your first foray into computer science?
No, actually, before that, I started doing computer modeling as a graduate student. And when my first faculty position was at Yale University at the then School of Forestry, now the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And a couple people knew I was using computers. And one of the graduate students came over and said, "The federal government is going to allow hunting of the sandhill crane." Now, the sandhill crane, it was an interesting bird. It was the first bird ever put legally as listed as an endangered species in about 1916, and it was an international treaty between the United States and Canada because the sandhill crane would fly between those two countries, you know, summer when wintering.
Mm-hmm.
And so it had been protected, but its protection had been so successful that it had gone from just a small number to well over 100,000, and it tended to fly as a single flock. And this 100,000 birds would land in a farmer's field and be like a plague of locusts. So the farmers thought there ought to be hunting season. And the conservationists, with this graduate student as their contact, came to me and they said they were afraid that the level of hunting that was going to be allowed by the new federal regulations would be too heavy for the sandhill cranes, and would this lead to their extinction? And so I made a computer model of the population history and forecasting the future of the sandhill crane. And we were able to show that the actual, just taking the data that the U.S. federal government was using their own data, the result would be the harvesting they were going to allow would lead to the extinction. So it meant that they had to reduce the level of hunting. It didn't mean they should not allow hunting, but they were allowing too much. So that was my first step into computer modeling related to environment. And then it's gone on. I've done work on the whooping crane. I've spent many years working with an expert on bowhead whales, John Bokstos, who's an ethnologist and historian and a major Arctic explorer. And he got the logbooks from the whaling ships that hunted bowhead whales from 1848 to 1914. And he got 20% of all the logbooks, and every day at noon, the first mate wrote down the weather, the sea conditions, the ice conditions, and where they were. And we had that digitized, and it ended up, there were about 500 voyages, that we had 65,000 days of observations. And so we did a lot of computer analysis to figure out what the original population was, what was happening to the bowheads now. And then they also, the whalers also recorded sea ice, and the bowheads tended to feed on the sea ice edge. That's because that's where the nutrients were, and the high productivity of what they fed on was greatest. And so we, when there became a big discussion in the climate problem about whether this Arctic sea ice was melting back, I went back and looked at these data, and we had 23,000 days in which the whalers noted where the sea ice was. And so we were able to compare sea ice in the 19th century, the extent of Arctic sea ice, with today's. So I've gone through a whole variety of different kinds of modeling, from populations of endangered species to dealing with forests at a very large scale.
And just to remind people, we're talking about the 60s here, so it's not, I don't imagine you were using anywhere near as close to as sophisticated a technology as we would use today.
Well, this is, we started in the 1960s, but of course they continued to use computers, and so now we use, of course, the most modern computers. But it was very interesting. IBM in 1970 at the Thomas J. Watson Research Lab had touch screen computers, And if we had a model, so we had this model of forest, and we would show the trees. If you wanted to cut down a tree, you touched the screen where that tree was, and it disappeared. So there was some surprisingly advanced stuff going on. But these, of course, were huge computers. They take up a whole big room. And now you can do this on a laptop.
Right. So I understand you've worked with NASA.
Yes. Yeah, NASA came to me originally because it was a popular idea in the 1970s to put people up into huge satellites that would go around the Earth. And one of the people who proposed this was a professor of engineering at Princeton. And he said, the biology is simple. You just sterilize everything and throw it up there. And several of us, including one of the astronauts and some other very good biologists, we got together and we wrote a paper about how difficult it would be to have people living in a space station. And NASA came to me, and the first thing they asked me to do was to lead a small group to talk about ecological life support systems for long-term space travel. And that was a small group. That was a lot of fun. It's very imaginative, and I always loved the idea of space travel. But then one day, the head of NASA's biological and medical research, who I'd gotten to know, named Jerry Soffan, called me up. He said, Dan, let's think big. There's something being called, this was 1980, he said, there's something being called global ecology. He said, what is that? And I have three questions for you. Is there such a science as global ecology? If so, could all the scientists from all the different disciplines that would be involved actually communicate with each other so they could work together to build computer forecasting models? And if those two were true, was there a role for NASA? And he asked me to run two long summer workshops that brought all those scientists together. So, you know, this is what now we call dealing with climate change and all the other large-scale global effects. And we decided that the answer to his three questions was positive. Yes, all this could happen. And so then he said, Dan, I want you to do the first terrestrial research, land research, using NASA's Landsat satellite. That was when Landsat was one of the first satellites that could look at the Earth's surface and look at forests. And so I developed a research project in northern Minnesota in what's called the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, which was America's first legally designated wilderness. And next to it was the Superior National Forest. And we had to get the Landsat imagery correlated so that it could understand what forests were really like. And so to do this, we had the same instrument that was in the satellite, in Landsat satellite, mounted in a helicopter. And then we had field crews go out and find uniform stands of trees that were large enough to be seen just as what they call one pixel, one unit of the Landsat satellite. And we had the people on the ground, graduate students and postdoctorates, measure the height and diameter of all the trees on these uniform forest stands, and they could then determine the total amount of organic material, which we call biomass, and the total carbon content. And then I'd be up in the helicopter with these helicopter pilots working for NASA, And we would fly over these and hover for 30 seconds and get the exact measurement with the Landsat device. And we did this for stands of forests at all different stages, young forests to old forests, of the five or six major forest species that lived in those forests. And then we were able to apply this to current and past NASA Landsat images, and we could compare those images, and we looked at how much the forest had changed in a 10-year period. So that's how I started working at with NASA, doing this global project. And that's been another thing that's fascinated me, that we can now look at the whole Earth and think about life on the Earth and people's connection to it.
And what conclusions were you able to draw from that 10-year study?
Well, the 10-year comparison, what we learned is that the forest changed much more rapidly than we expected. You see, the old idea going back to the ancient Greeks and Roman philosophers was that nature undisturbed was never changing. There was a balance of nature. And nature, except for people's disturbance, reached a fixed state called the climax state and always stayed there. And this is still a dominant belief among many environmentalists, but that's not the way nature actually works. Many species of trees and many kinds of wildlife have evolved with and require change. And so fire and other kinds of disturbance are necessary for them to persist. So I understood this, and that was one of the points I made in a lot of my writings and research. But when we did the NASA study and compared a NASA image of the same forest from 10 years apart to two images, we were surprised to find that even what were supposed to be old growth, never changing forests, half of them changed their condition in just 10 years. So we learned that forests were much more dynamic and changeable than even I had thought, even though I was one of the people that said nature's not constant, nature's changing. So it was a fascinating observation.
And I want to move into one of your other interests, which is folk music. You mentioned your father being an influential figure in the folklore community. How did you get your start?
Well, I grew up listening to folk music. My father had one of the first reel-to-reel tape recorders and lots of folk musicians like Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie would come and visit and sing. And a lot of young folk musicians. This was in the 50s and 60s, and folk music was then becoming very popular. And so I was playing classical music instruments, but one of the folk musicians came in and said to me, "Dan, you're surrounded by folk music. Here's a guitar and a banjo." And she gave me, it was a wonderful woman, folk singer, gave me those instruments and showed me a few chords and so forth. And so I started singing. But I had been singing without any instruments since I was 5 years old. And when I was 6 and a half, my father was then head of the folklore archives of the Library of Congress. And they had an old-fashioned radio booth like you see in the old movies with an on-the-air sign and a glassed-in room where you stood and did your singing, and you could look out and see the technical people. And he had me made a 78 record when I was 6 and a half. And I sang folk songs when I was in college. I'd sing in the coffee houses. That was a popular thing to do, to make a little side money. But I didn't pursue it as a career because I knew so many much better musicians than I was, who were folk musicians. But then in the last few years, 5 years I'd say now, it became clear that, you know, we're living in such a divisive time and people are so angry with each other in the United States. It's very troubling. And I decided to make a folk music record. And the music video producer, listening to me, I didn't just sing folk songs. I told a story about each song, its origin, because American folk music has such diverse and wonderful background. Some of the songs go back 2,000 years. Others are very recent. And we sat down, and in between the recording time, a bunch of musicians would sit around in the main room and talk, and there was always peaceful, friendly conversation. And so the music video producer, whose name is Sergio Cavalieri, he's a Brazilian and had sold 2 million albums in his native Brazil, he and I decided that we really should make a project about folk music, which we called What Makes Us One. Because in past times, whenever there's been a huge dissension in the United States, there's always been protest songs. I mean, think of We Shall Overcome. But today, we have lots of dissension and lots of anger, and we don't have any protest songs. So we decided it was time to bring folk music back. And what we did was we got young singers who weren't trained in folk music, and we'd sing them, or I'd sing them or have them play them a record of a traditional folk song and say, do it your way. And the results we thought were just beautiful. And so we created a 50-minute DVD and a little booklet that tells about folklore and the role of arts in society, and 2 CDs of just music to try to help start people thinking again about how music brings people together, how soothing it can be, and about why aren't we making protest songs that help bring people together and get to solutions to their problems. So this has become a kind an add-on secondary career for me.
So what role specifically does protest music play in, let's say, a counterculture movement?
It doesn't have to be a counterculture movement. It could be a major movement. I mean, like We Shall Overcome, that had a, you know, that brought people together over the racial problems in the United States. And during World War II, Woody Guthrie wrote songs supporting the soldiers. And in fact, Woody Guthrie, who wrote a lot of songs that are now considered folk songs, he was said to be the first employee hired by the Bonneville Power Administration. That's the administration that built the big hydroelectric dams on the Columbia River. And they hired Woody Guthrie to write songs. He wrote 22 songs to promote the idea that these dams would bring electricity and in more industry to the area. And so this isn't just counterculture. That was really central to this corporate activity. And folk music has always been, until our decades right now, it's always been a very important part of human life. People have always sung as a way to get on together, to deal with their differences. Music is very, very moving. In fact, it's very, very helpful for people with Alzheimer's disease. It's soothing and helps bring people together. So you don't want to think of it as a counterculture. it thing, you think of it as one of the fundamental activities that are so meaningful to human beings, and also something that even a big, huge, semi-federal agency, the Bonneville Power Administration, saw as a way to promote this radical development of these big dams.
You mentioned the unifying aspect of folk music. Today, I'm sure you've noticed in our politics and in our lives, we've become so polarized and divided against each other. Do you see folk music as being a way to get these two, or sometimes more than two, ideologies together, or is it different than that? Is it just trying to find some form of common ground, even if we don't agree on everything?
Well, you know, it's a good question. It works in a lot of complex ways. First of all, if you're angry, rather than just stay angry, if you start writing songs and singing them together, that takes away some of the intense anger and can help get people away from violence. And it brings them together in a very spiritual way. And so that helps the different groups. But then, as with We Shall Overcome, these then lead to people on different sides being able to communicate with each other. Music provides a kind of soothing rather than an angry way of dealing with things. And so it can help bring people from both sides in a calmer way to work out their differences. Now, I'm not saying it's the total solution. I'm saying it's a very helpful aid that goes back all the way through human civilization.
So is there anything that we have not covered yet that you feel deserves a little extra attention?
Well, I was one of the first people to, there was a small group of us in 1968 who found out that there was amazing measurements of trace gases in the atmosphere of the Earth, and that carbon dioxide was increasing. And the small group, it was people in ecology, my field, and in meteorology and climatology. There were some meetings and publications where we all became concerned about whether we were actually going to cause a major global warming. And so I started reading up on that. I spent 6 months reading on the physics and chemistry of carbon dioxide to find out how this trace gas that's a 1,000th percentage concentration of water vapor, which is the major greenhouse gas, how could this have a significant effect? And this then led me through the development of my forest models, and also I had graduate students who worked on climate change models, and I did some work on climate change models myself, to focus on this. And so I've actually worked on the whole issue of climate change for 50 years. And my concern about it now is that it's moved away from being a scientific study to becoming a political and ideological issue, where it really needs to be solid science. It's very easy for environmental issues to move from science to emotion, because people love nature, they love the outdoors, and so it gets into their hearts, and so they often see it as more an emotional issue. But if you abandon the science and only depend on what politicians and pundits and ideologists have to say, you can never get to the real answer. So I maintain some work on climate change, but I'm very saddened and discouraged that it's become more of a political issue rather than a fundamental scientific research topic from which we can really understand what we're doing or not doing.
Well, in the interest of contributing to that that dispassionate scientific study, what have been your results, your conclusions, I should say, on climate change?
Through the 1980s, it appeared to me and my colleagues that we were, in fact, probably causing a warming. But then a lot of remarkable new studies were done. There are these ice cores in Antarctica that go back hundreds of thousands of years, and they lead to some very amazing results. For example, they can, through in these ice cores, there are air bubbles that are caught in the ice, and they can determine the carbon dioxide concentration and the temperature at the time. And these show that carbon dioxide doesn't lead change, that the temperature changes, and then either carbon dioxide changes almost right after or up to a couple hundred years after. This is still an area of active research. So there's more and more evidence that our role may be much smaller than we originally thought. And that's where we have to be open to considering this very seriously. What is the extent that we may be or maybe not affecting climate change? I think that we as a society in the United States, at least in the United States and everywhere, have to understand that we are deeply part of nature. Human beings have it's been a modern idea that people were separated from nature. Nature was out there, we were here. But that's not the truth, and that's not what Henry David Thoreau understood. He said he liked wilderness, but what he really liked was a town on the edge of a deep marsh. It was the combination of the richness of civilization and the richness of nature together that made the most wonderful world. And so we have to see ourselves as within and part of nature. And I wish we could do this with maybe the help of folk music. I wish we could do this in a calmer way and a less ideological way. But we really have to see ourselves as part of nature, not outside it. And that's what I would like to end my discussion.
Thank you, Daniel, for taking the time out of your day to share your story with our listeners. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to Marquee Radio. Stay tuned for more in-depth and informative interviews with professionals from all walks of life.